Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's give a rousing welcome to our warm-up speaker all the way from north of Modesto, Doug.
I guess I'll step back here. Hi, I'm Doug, and I am an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is June 21st, 1998. I'm definitely an alcoholic. I belong in these rooms. It took me a long time to figure that out. I guess a quick story is I started drinking at a very early age. I'm about 13, 14 is when we started stealing alcohol and going out with my friends, and I was always the guy that drank the most. So that's kind of how it started out. My very first drunk was from my stepdad. We came from Michigan, and back there, I guess it's pretty normal to take your kids into bars and get them hammered. Doesn't matter what age, it's all perfectly acceptable. And actually, believe it or not, it still is today. So that surprises me. I was in Milwaukee on a business trip a while back and noticed a family over sitting in the corner at a sports bar drinking, and they had like their little five-year-old kid up there, and he was drinking with the family. And I'm like, wow, you know, what year is this? But again, I started out drinking at an early age. I came from an alcoholic family. It was an abusive family. Like most alcoholic dysfunctional homes are, they're usually pretty good amount of dysfunction. So that's the life I grew up in. Drank and did all the cousins all the way through high school. You know, I was a product of the 80s, so that was all good, right? It was all about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. So I tried to make that my mission, and I carried that on for 25 years, you know. Caused a lot of wreckage along the way, got a lot of DUIs, wrecked a lot of cars. One of my favorite pastimes to do was to drink and drive something with a motor in it. So I live down in Modesto. Keys is actually where we're from, north of Modesto. I know all the back roads up in the mountains up there, Sonora, Yosemite. So I don't remember half the trips, but I know I've been all over up there with guns and fishing poles and motorcycles. So most of it was in a blackout. I was a blackout drinker. My very first blackout was probably 15 years old. Me and some friends were out cruising McHenry Avenue, and again, I'm probably the first guy drunk, and so we're cruising, and I start feeling not so good, and I end up throwing up on everybody in the car, and then I don't remember much more than that. My parents, I guess, scooped me off the front yards, or my friends kicked me out and left me. So, you know, that's kind of some of my history. I'm an alcoholic. I would say, you know, I was about 36 when I pretty much discovered that I drank all the fun out of the bottle. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, and I really didn't know what to do other than continue to drink and continue to try to find different methods like they talk about on, you know, try to control it. You know, switching up, changing this and that, the other, and none of it really worked. My life was falling apart from the outside. Our home looked like two cars, big house, two kids in, you know, in school. But inside, it was chaos. It was a total meltdown. And I knew that it was going to come apart here pretty quick. I was either going to end up dead or locked up, because that's where I had been taking this all along. You know, I've been incarcerated many times short-term at the farm, you know, the local farm. I knew that place well. Worked furlough, did a lot of those, but, you know, it was really didn't get through to me. But, you know, the damage was getting deeper and longer every time. So, at any rate, I had a coworker that I knew, and I heard a lot of horror stories, you know, the war stories that you hear from coworkers. And, you know, that person I know, I couldn't picture him with the stories. But yet, you know, they're all true, apparently. And so anyways, he doesn't drink anymore. And so I kind of built up the courage one day to ask him if he could help me out. And so that's kind of how I got my introduction into AA. I wanted to find out how he was able to control his drinking. And so he rounded me up and told me to come meet him at this place and to just sit back and listen, and afterwards we talked. And so, you know, we walked into a place called Freeway Fellowship, and that's in Modesto, California, right off 99, right there in the great part of Modesto. And I walk in the door, and there's just a cloud of smoke in the room, and there's winos, and, you know, there's just, I'm walking in, and I'm like, what the heck? What is this? And so I sit down, and, you know, afterwards we talk, but, you know, I right out of the gate, I had already made up my mind, this wasn't for me. I'm not like these people in this room here, you know, I'm not like that. And so he told me to just keep coming back and listen, and, you know, we talk. And so basically after about 30 days of coming to this place and listening to people share, I had come to the conclusion that, yeah, I was just like those other people out there. I was an alcoholic. It didn't take me long to listen to my story being told by different people, different parts and pieces. You know, I put it all together on my own. I was able to figure that out. And so there starts my journey to, you know, sobriety. I discovered shortly after that I wasn't going to be allowed to control my drinking, you know, so that was kind of a big letdown, because that was the impression, that was kind of the deal I thought we had, is you were going to teach me how to control my drinking. But, you know, that didn't work out that way, and actually a lot of things haven't worked out the way I thought they were going to be. You know, this program is a beautiful thing. You know, it gave me a life back. It gave me hope. You know, when I came into these rooms, when I was sick and tired and I talked to that friend, I was at my wit's end. I mean, I really was. I was hitting it hard every day. The destruction was getting worse. I'm afraid to think, you know, how much farther I could have taken it. I'm still considered a high bottom drunk. You know, I know lots of other friends who have taken it all the way down, and you know, I'm thankful I didn't have to go there. Obviously it still waits for me out there. You know, I know I'm just one drink away. And well, you know, today I'm happy. I met a beautiful woman in recovery. We're going to celebrate 10 years of marriage here this year, which is kind of funny because when I first came into the room, I was in a relationship, and I actually fought through that for about 5 years. I got sober and the other didn't, and it drove me out of my mind, you know, trying to stay sober the first few years with that kind of madness in the house. You know, it gave me a glimpse of what it must have looked like from the other side of me. But yeah, unfortunately, you know, I mean, it didn't work out. And unfortunately, got a follow up a couple of years ago from my oldest son that his mother actually passed away. She died in her disease. She never could get it, and so it took her out. But you know, I'm grateful. You know, I didn't think I was ever going to have another life again. You know. When I first came into these rooms, I thought it was going to be the glum, teetotaling, oh my God, this is what I'm doomed to, you know. But nothing like that at all. I mean, today I have a wonderful life. I've got a great job, great friends. I have real friends today. I have friends that aren't just wondering what I'm carrying around, you know, what's in it for me today. Yeah, I mean, I have hope. This is the thing. This is the deal. This is the real deal. You know, I hope I get to continue on and to continue to spread the word. This is my first time ever being front and center under the spotlight, so I'm kind of a little uneasy here. But, yeah, it's something that I hope I get to continue on. I hope I get to take this to my grave. So that's about it for me. So I'm the warm-up, and now you get my lovely wife next. So thank you.
Rousing Tulare County welcome for our featured speaker, Leslie.
Yes. Okay. That's just a little intimidating, isn't it? Hi, I'm Leslie. I'm an alcoholic. Boy, I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous for 25 years. I claim 15 years of sobriety, and my sobriety date is October 10th, 2001. And I grew up in Stockton, California, and I'm an oldest child of two. I have a younger sister who's still in her addiction. And like Doug, I grew up in a dysfunctional alcoholic addict home. And, you know, it was on the outside of my house, it looked pretty normal, I guess, too. You know, my dad was a typical middle-class engineer, worked at a bakery in the water boilers and stuff like that. And we had two cars in the drive and a nice house. But on the inside of my house, it was another story. It was chaos and violence, and it was not a nice place to live. So early on, alcohol for me was an ability to escape my environment. It wasn't until I got older that alcohol became a social kind of thing for me. So my first drinks were snitching drinks around my parents' parties. You know, they'd be passed out, and there'd be alcohol all over the place, and I would go around shaking cans and looking in glasses, make sure there was no cigarette butts in there, and snitching drinks of whatever my parents were drinking the night before. I still remember a few of those beer cans. I stayed away from beer cans after, you know, a few of those cigarette butts. That's pretty gross. But, I know that there's people who come into Alcoholics Anonymous that come from normal households and they become alcoholics. You know, alcohol is definitely cunning, baffling, and powerful. And what makes, like my sponsor used to say, once a pickle, a cucumber becomes a pickle, and they can never go back to being a cucumber, you know. And that was me. I got pickled, I think, at a very young age. And like I said, I grew up in a really violent household, and so alcohol was definitely an escape for me. And my drug of choice is more. Whatever you had, I wanted more of it. And so if you were drinking, I was drinking. If you were doing meth, I was doing meth. If you were doing heroin, I was doing heroin. So whatever you did, I wanted more of it. And it went like that for a very long time for me. My years at home were in and out of my house. To first it was CPS services and Fairgram Hall for the abused, and then it later went on to group homes and foster homes, to juvenile facilities, juvenile hall, court-mandated youth centers, which were really just prisons for kids. And I never learned anything from those places except for how to be worse, you know. I'm sure that there's some places out there that mean well for kids that are struggling to have a hard time, but I never found any of those places in the 18 years that I was in the system. And but that's my story. And so every year I got older, I just had more, you know, illegal activities added to my resume of life. And pretty soon it wasn't about ever going back to being normal, because I really didn't know what normal was. And so by the time I got up into my high school years, I had already had a pretty long, lengthy juvenile record. My father went to prison when I was 16 for murder, and my mother moved away on me while I was locked up in juvenile hall for accessory to that murder. And I went into the system and ran away as soon as I got a chance to, and ended up in the streets of San Francisco. And I I quickly found out that out there, being a young white girl in the Tenderloin in San Francisco, you better have some hustle and gain or you're going to get killed. And so I learned about prostitution, and I learned about drug slinging, and I added some more really bad things to my resume. And so I did that for a couple of years, and ended up back down in the Central Valley. At 18 years of age, I hitchhiked back down here trying to find my mom. And I ended up with some really bad people, of course, because that's the kind of people I hung out with, was bad people. Imagine that. And we were in this car, and you got to remember, a lot of my years back then were kind of foggy, so things kind of blur together sometimes, and I have a hard time remembering certain things. But we ended up in this car in South Modesto, and it had no windshield, and it had no rear window, and it was running around on two of those little donut spare tires in the back. And we had a plastic Visqueen or some kind of clear plastic bags covering the front windows and the back windows, but we kept having to poke holes in it because every time we go over 20 miles an hour, it just kept wanting to suck in. And so we kept poking holes in the plastic to try to get down the road, and we get to the top of the overpass hill and we run out of gas. Like, oh shit, anybody check the gas tank? Like, well, the gas gauge doesn't work. Well, imagine that, you know, gas gauge doesn't work on a car with no windshield and no rear window. So anyway, so we're walking back down into to try to find a gas station. We got a milk jug to get some gas and put in this car. And the police do random sweeps in the neighborhood I was in. I was on what's called the Host Row in Modesto, California, which is 9th Street. And where I'm with this guy, and I'm going, oh, shit, I got warrants for my arrest. And the guy goes, yeah, I got warrants for my arrest, too. I go, well, what should we do? And he goes, well, just keep walking, and hopefully they won't pay any attention to us. And we'd been up for, like, maybe 14 days. So we were really inconspicuous, you know. Two tweakers walking down the road with a milk jug, you know. And back then, my hair was, like, sticking out 50,000 directions. And I had big old dark circles under my eyes, and I had to wear size zeros with suspenders to hold them up. So anyway, so we're walking down the road, and the cops look over at us, and they go, you two, come here. Like, what, us? No, the two behind you. No, yeah, you two, come here. And so we walked over, and they said, what's your name? And I just stood there for a second. I'm thinking, should I lie? Should I lie? Should I lie? Oh, I can't think the lie. I've been awake too many days. What do I do? What do I do? And I just told him my name. He goes, okay, wait here. He goes back to his car, da-da-da-da, comes back. He goes, okay, you're going to jail. And the guy I'm with starts turning around, and he goes, no, not you, her. She's going to jail. I'm like, oh, shit. So I go, okay. I go, come bail me out. Come bail me out. He goes, no, you're not going anywhere. You can get bailed out. You've got a juvenile warrant, and you're going to juvenile hall. And I'm like, but I'm 18. Why am I going to juvenile hall? He goes, you can go to juvenile hall up to you're 27 years old. So here I've been out on the street solid for 2 years, been not acting like an 18-year-old child at all in any way, shape, or form, and I'm about to get thrown into a facility full of children, in my opinion. And that's not the place I want to go. So I get there, and I go through the booking process and everything, and all I want is just a cell, because I know that it's going to be bad, because I'm going to detox. And, you know, being a poor white girl out on the streets, there's been many times when I haven't been able to have enough hustle to get any drugs or alcohol or whatever it was that I needed at the time to get me through. So detox was a really bad experience, and I knew it was going to be bad. And so all I wanted was a bed, and I was hoping that I'd get something from somebody, but being in juvenile hall, I doubted it. And so I went in, and for the first 4 days of being locked up, I just DT'd real bad. They took me to the hospital, and they gave me some drug that I ended up having an allergic reaction to, and they had to take me back to the hospital to give me some other drug and find out that I had whiplash, because 4 days earlier, I'd gotten into a fight with some guy over some drugs, and he ended up hitting me on the back of the head with a 2x4, but I'd been up for so long that I didn't realize that I had whiplash, because, you know, I was out doing the bad things. And so I woke up with whiplash in juvenile hall, and they had already stuck all kinds of other drugs in me, because, you know, some drugs fix other drugs, but whatever. So anyway, so I'm there, and I'm hating life, and I'm just wondering what's going to happen. I end up going to court, and court says, well, you're an 18-year-old girl with no parents to speak of, and so you have a dilemma. Usually we have to release you to parents even though you're an adult, because that's what we do here. But because you have no parents, we're going to treat you like an adult, and we're going to release you at midnight in 120 days. I said, okay, so I got to do 120 days. No problem. So it's Christmas time, and H&I comes to juvenile hall, and they bring us pencils and socks and a message. And I didn't want to have no part of that message. And so I'm sitting there at this round table all by myself, because I give the dirty looks to anybody who comes and tries to sit by me. And I'm totally don't have nothing to do with me. I've got the I don't want to talk to you bubble going on. And when anybody ever tried to tell me anything that was good for me, you know, the teacher from the Peanuts, the wah, wah, wah. That's how anybody who said, Leslie, you need to, they immediately sounded like wah, wah, wah. And I didn't hear anything else after that phrase. Leslie, you need to, wah, 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 wah. And so that's how my life went. And I'm sitting there at this table, and this big, burly biker guy comes over and sits down as if I invited him there. And he looks me up and down, and you gotta remember, like 80 pounds soaking wet, hair sticking out 50,000 directions, big dark circles under my eyes, skunked in cheeks, track marks up both arms. I was just sexy. I knew it too. And he sits down, he looks me up and down, and he goes, so how long have you been a dope fiend? I go, what makes you think I'm a dope fiend? And he grabs a hold of my wrist and stretches my arm out, and of course I stretch it back. And he starts wah, wah, wah away across from me at the table. And I zoned him out, and I'm just wishing that he'd hurry up and say what he's got to say and leave me alone. And I know now that God was speaking to me then, because that's how God speaks to me, is through people. And I heard this. Wah, 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 if you're sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I was. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. When I was a little girl, I didn't grow up aspiring to be a dope fiend, prostitute, thief, and all the other things that I added to my resume. I wanted to be a teacher or a doctor or a nurse or so many other of the professions that people respect, you know. So, yes, I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I looked at him and I said, how do you know what my life is like? How do you know what I've been through? How do you, can you sit there and say that you can give me a better life? He said, I didn't say I could give you a better life. He said, but I know that if you're sick and tired of being sick and tired, I know a way. And he dared me to sit through the next, I had like 80 days left of my sentence. He goes, just go to the AA meeting, sit there, don't say anything, you don't have to do nothing, just come and sit. You ain't got nothing else better to do anyway. He goes, there's coffee there. Coffee sounded good. So I came and I sat, and I remember my first meeting sitting there in juvenile hall. This perky little woman, she came in, she had this big stupid smile on her face, and she didn't look like she would last 10 minutes on the streets before she was dead in the gutter. She just looked just too innocent, too perfect, and could not possibly know the things that I'd went through. She was smiling. Hi, I'm such and such. I'm so glad you're here. Welcome to our meeting. I was like, yeah, where's the coffee? So I sat there through the meeting, and I heard a lot of people talking. But I think the thing that I heard the most was God and fuck in the same sentence a lot. And, you know, it just didn't seem like it was going to be my fit at first. And then as the fog started to clear and the haze lifted and I started not to hear the want, want, want so much and started hearing what people said, I started hearing about how tragic some people's lives were and how that cute little perky girl who had came in who annoyed me so much had been raised in a crack house and her mother was still out there on the streets and how she grew up homeless and had been through so many things and her life had turned around and she was so grateful for the program. And I wanted that too. I didn't want to do all the work. You know, you can keep the steps, you can keep the book, just give me the house and the husband and the kids and the dog and the picket fence and the nice life. You guys can keep all the rest. And so for the next 90 days, I went to AA meetings and I go, I got this. I can do this. I can stay sober. I'm going to get that husband. I'm going to get that house. I'm going to have that perfect life. So I get out of jail and I don't know who I'm going to call. Who do I call to come get me? Well, I could call these list of AA people, or I could call this list of drug people that I know in my phone. AA people, drug people. Drug people. They'll beat you quicker. La la la. Yes, I'm in jail. Come get me. 4 hours later, somebody shows up to come and pick me up. Who the hell are you? Well, I'm friends with such and such and such and such, and they said that I needed to pick up some girl, and she's going to be here, and now I'm here, and I'm coming to get you to take you back. And I'm like, okay. So they take me back, and I ran into the person that I was looking for, and I said, you know what? I said, I've decided I'm going to do this AA thing, and the first thing is I can't drink and I can't use. And he's like, cool. He goes, I don't want to drink or use either. I go, well, I can't stay here in this town because if I stay here, I'm going to drink and use because that's all I know is people who drink and use. He goes, well, he goes, I have a house. Where's your house? It's in Oklahoma. So let's go to Oklahoma. So we stole a Camaro. And we're off to Oklahoma with no money in our pocket, no clothes to speak of, in a stolen car. And I'll tell you what, it was hard to get to Texas in a stolen car. We got chased. We went into a mall and sat and waited for this cop to go away, and he still was there 2 hours later when we came out of the mall, circling the mall, looking for us. But we managed to get 12 days. It took us 12 days to get from California to Oklahoma panhandling all the way. And halfway there, someone stole our seat, my seat, not his seat, stole my seat, because we had to take the seats out at night and set them outside the car, and then we'd lay out whatever was in the car to lay on and sleep at night, and then we'd buckle the bolt the seats back down the next day and take off. Well, in the middle of the night one night, some asshole stole my seat. I was stuck sitting on a milk crate halfway to freaking Oklahoma. I had waffle butt for days. I didn't think to put any kind of patty on it till we were like almost to Oklahoma. So I sat on a milk crate for who knows how long without no padding on my little bony butt. So we get to Oklahoma, and I'm like so ready. I'm thinking to myself, okay, I've got the man. I'm going to a house. Next thing is going to be marriage, and then the kids, and I'm going to have this. I'm going to have the AA life. So we pull up, and I'm like, okay, we're here. I go, where's the buses? He goes, there are no buses. I go, where are the taxis? He goes, there are no taxis. I go, well, how do you get through town? He goes, well, you see this street here? I go, yeah. He goes, this is town. I was like, take me back to California. Take me back. I cannot live here. And he goes, wait till you see the house. You're going to love it. You're going to love it. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, right. It's in the middle of some hick town. How great could it be? So we pull up to this beautiful house on the hill. Not. It was a double-wide trailer. Well, actually, it was a single-wide trailer smashed together with another single-wide trailer to make a double-wide trailer. on the top of a hill overlooking the bank of her lake, because you couldn't even see the lake because the bank, cause it was like little hill, big hill, and of course the house was sitting on the little hill, and the big hill was here blocking the view of the lake. So if you wanted to see the lake, you had to walk down the little hill, up the big hill, and then you could see the lake. So anyway, and it had tweaker plumbing. You guys know what tweaker plumbing is? All pipes go somewhere, but never where they're supposed to, and they kind of all end up into each other. And the toilet actually didn't have a septic. It went into the cave that was under the hill, so you had to go to the bathroom with a fly swatter to kill anything that came up out of the bowl while you were trying to go. And after some kind of like rat thing came up one time, I started carrying a hammer instead of a fly swatter. There's my house. I've got the man. I've got the house. I'm halfway there to AA life. And I haven't even worked my first step. Awesome. So, there I am. And I'm like, okay, I guess I need to go to those meeting things that they talked about inside AA, because I just don't think I can go another day without going and hitting one of those bars, because it's like bar, church, bar, church, bar, church, laundromat, cop shop, bar, church, bar, church, bar, church, post office, tiki hut, / I can't remember, I think it was like canning salon, tiki hut, / mail post office box kind of thing on the other side. And that was all that was to town. And I was like, so I'm going to end up in one of those bars if I don't do something. So I said, let's go find an AA meeting. And he goes, I'm not going to go to an AA meeting. I got to get a job. I was like, okay, fine, go get a job. And I walked into an AA meeting in Oklahoma, and I remember them saying, if you have less than 5 years, sit down and shut up. If you have not got anything good to say, if you got less than 1 year, sit down, shut up, pull the cotton out of your ears and stick it in your mouth. And that was my impression of God at first in AA in Oklahoma. It had very strong spiritual beliefs there. And I remember my sponsor there, she's like, you had made your bed and now you kind of lie in it, kind of philosophy. So I picked the man that I was with and I made that bed and now I had to lie in it. And I picked the house I was in, so I made that bed and I had to lie in it. I was really not liking the beds I was making. And so, of course, you know, sat in the meetings, didn't go anywhere, didn't talk to anybody, did kind of like the same thing I did in juvenile hall, just sat there, shut up, and pretended like I was absorbing all this great knowledge, and osmosis. And so, you know, you go to Alcoholics Anonymous and you have an off-the-wall program when you work the steps off the wall. I've learned that. And I didn't even work the steps off the wall. I just kind of like picked this one here, picked that one there, and I'll never do this one here. And well, it'll be the last breath I ever take before I do that one. And maybe this one will be okay. And I could kind of get with this one. It was kind of like my philosophy on it. And that book was just way too big. It didn't have pictures. I wasn't going to read it. Sorry if they made an illustrated version of it. Maybe I can handle it. But just couldn't do it. So, I had this crazy psycho problem, but I had a really great sponsor. I do have to say that, because I didn't pick her. Oh, imagine that. Out there, they don't let you pick your sponsor. They pick you. Like, I'm going to work with you. This is my number. Call me at this time, and that's the end of it. So, she was great. She was tolerant. She was wonderful. She had faith in me before I had faith in myself. So, and that's a great thing. Even though she never really did get much of any step work or anything like that out of me. But it was my first go round, so I have excuses. And you know what they say about excuses. I don't need to say anymore. But anyway, because I was full of those. You know, I was young and I was stupid. And then I got older and was still stupid. But, you know, because I stayed married to that man for 10 years. I had 2 kids with him. I did not drink and I did not use for 9 years and 10 months. And I half-assed this program to the most half-assed and in its way a person can half-ass it. And my life was miserable. It was. My life did not get better. I did not get the damn promises, and I wanted a refund. So I got it, too. I got that refund. So for 9 years and 10 months, I am absolutely miserable. Episodes of running down my driveway half naked with a baseball bat, chasing my now addicted husband for my money that he stole that belongs to the rent lady who's coming tomorrow to pick it up so she can go get loaded, were the types of episodes that I had married to him. Episodes of him beating the living tar out of me because he thought some guy looked at me too closely, or that I didn't clean the dishes good enough. I essentially married my dad, which is just really sick. But so anyway, and I stayed with him for 10 years because I thought I could fix him. I was one of those, you know, codependent, you know, like I said, I'm just a bottle, just a bag of mess. And so anyway, so I thought for sure that if I could fix him, that I'm going to get that AA dream again. I'm going to have that picket house and best kids in the world, and, you know, everything's going to be perfect. Well, it didn't happen. And my sponsor, Jeannie, she just kept telling me, you made your bed, you left a lie in it. You have to make the best of things, you know. Just keep trying, keep trying. Maybe you should go to some Al-Anon meetings, or maybe you should try going to these meetings. Maybe you should try reading your book. Maybe you should try meditating. Maybe you should try talking to God. Like, how is any of that going to fix my freaking problems? He's a damn drug addict who won't stay home and steals from me all the time. And so I decided I was not going to get any help in Oklahoma. So I decided to come back to California. And I could do that because I was working two jobs, and I was the one supporting the family, and so I had been rat-holing money. And when my tax return came, I bought a motorhome. And I came back to California in style, in my motorhome. And I decided that the first time he went and got loaded, I was throwing his crap out of my motorhome, and I was divorcing him because I was not putting up with it anymore. So we parked our motorhome in front of his sister's house, and he said he was going to mow the lawn one day with the brand new lawnmower I had bought. That lawnmower never started. I was sitting there for like an hour, and it's like, did you ever hear the lawnmower start? My sister-in-law looks over at me and goes, no, I didn't hear the lawnmower start. He pushed the damn lawnmower to the connections and sold it. Never cut not one blade of my grass, ever, that lawnmower. So I said, finally, and I boxed this stuff up, and I set it out the door. I said, I'm done with him. 10 years of being married to this man and putting up with this crap, I'm done. I'm going to get my AA perfect life, finally. So he proceeds to stalk me. He comes to my school because I'm going to school to become an accountant, and I'm working at a convenience store, and I'm trying to get my life better. And every time I took 2 steps forward, I ended up taking 4 steps back. I try to go to school, and I end up losing my job. I try to keep a job, and I end up not getting enough hours. There was always some kind of chaos going on in my life, always. Either he was too hungover, passed out, he couldn't watch the kids, or he flirted with the babysitter, or tried to get the babysitter loaded one time, and they quit on me. You know, it was always some kind of drug or alcohol-related drama in my life. And I was just had the blinders on for such a long time that I couldn't see that the reason why my life was not getting better was because this disease centers in our mind. Abstinence from the alcohol still leaves me with this sick, broken brain. And so even though I wasn't drinking and I wasn't using and I wasn't working this program like I was supposed to be working it, and so I couldn't get my life better. But I wasn't done yet. So I told him, I'm not going to take you back. I'm done. And he came from a family of 6 brothers and 6 sisters, so there was 13 in his family. And half his family were criminals, degenerate drug addicts, and the other half were kind of criminal, degenerate drug addicts. They were kind of like the higher bottom drunks that we get around here, like my husband. You know, where they have the job still, and they kind of do life still, and they kind of pass off that everything's going okay, and then they go home, close the doors, and all hell breaks loose, but nobody's allowed to see it. So that's half his family. So half his family is like, good for you, Leslie. We're glad you're standing up to him. And the other half is like, take his stupid ass back. We don't want him around. Us, take him back. And so my sister-in-law felt really conflicted about me staying in her front yard with my trailer and me not letting her brother come home. And unbeknownst to me, he came to her while I was at work one day, or school one day, one of the two. I was either working that day, that night, and going to school that day. Anyway, he shows up and says, hey, I'll make a deal with you. You kick your Leslie out of the house, and I'll get custody of the kids, and I'll give you the welfare check just for kicking her out. And she's like, okay, that sounds like a good plan to me. But I knew better because I knew him. He wasn't going to fork over no welfare check to her because he's a drug addict and he's going to do all that welfare check himself. So I come home from work or school. I can't remember which. She says, Leslie, you got to go. I just can't take it anymore. My sisters are threatening to beat me up if I don't kick you out or if you don't let Alan come back home. So you're going to have to go. I'm like, when? She's like, now. I'm like, where am I supposed to go? I don't have any money. I go, well, give me my rent back. I just paid you. Sure, I'm sorry. That went to the rent. You can't have that money back. I go, well, I just paid it. I'm broke. Well, you're still going to have to leave. So I went down to welfare. And welfare put me up in a motel over on 9th Street, the Hostro again. So here I was 10 years later, back on the same strip that I'd left 10 years prior, with no money, no job, no school, no house. My kids scared to death because they'd never seen anything like this. And I'm like, my life has gone full circle. Here I am, back broke in the same part of town that I left. What is this saying to me? So I call him up like an idiot, and I told him, I said, okay, we're at a motel. The kids are missing you. You want to say something to him? He goes, yeah, I want to talk to him. He goes, I want to see him. I go, well, have you gotten loaded today? He goes, no, I haven't gotten loaded today, I promise. I said, okay, and I told him where we were at, and he showed up. And he goes, okay. He goes, so I got you kicked out of school. I got you fired from your job. I got you kicked out of Donna's. He goes, are you done yet? I go, no, I'm not done yet. I'm not ever going back to you again. I'm done. I'm divorcing you. And he says, well, he goes, and I'm going to take your kids. And he threw down temporary custody papers and a restraining order against me for hiding his children from him. And he goes, come on, kids, you're going with me. And I'm like, over my dead body, you're going out the door with my kids. And he opens up the door, and there's the sheriff sitting out there against his car. And he's like, do we have any problem? And I go, no, we have no problem. So he packed up my kids, and my kids are screaming and crying and not wanting to go with him because they really don't really know him, because he's always out on these long drug runs. And I'm watching my kids, who at the time I didn't know were my higher power. They were the reason why. That's my daughter. Let me turn her off because she'll keep calling. They were my higher power. They were the reason why I had enough will, enough strength not to drink those 9 years and 10 months. You know, I always thought to myself, if I got drunk or I got loaded, who's going to take care of these two? Nobody. Nobody. I didn't know where my parents were. My father was in prison, and my sister was out in her addiction, and there was nobody to take care of my kids, so I didn't drink and I didn't use. And there they went off in this car crying, beating on the back window, wanting their mommy. And this guy, I'm standing there in a parking lot, and this guy comes up to me, and he's drinking, and I could smell the alcohol. And he's hitting on me, but I'm not even, he's wah, 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 you know how that goes. So I smell the alcohol, and I take his glass, and I drink it, and I was like, oh, that will fix this. And I walk across the street to the convenience store, and I get a bottle of 151, and I have $467 that welfare just gave me for the next week, for the next month, being, you know, on welfare now, because I didn't have a job or any place to live. So I had plenty of money now, and I stepped out on the sidewalk and proceeded to drink that bottle and had the man come out. No, you can't drink in here. Go down to the streets. You can't drink in front of my store. And I stepped out further, finished my drink, turned around, went back in, and got another bottle. And I, every time I downed one, I turned back around and I went in for another one. and there just was not enough booze to take that hurt away of my kids leaving. Just not enough booze. So, the next 3 days, I drank, and I finally decided on the third day that I was going to need something a little bit stronger. And so I was looking to find a connection so that I could just OD and end it all, because I was not going to get that AA perfect life. I wasn't going to get that house. I wasn't getting my kids. And I just gave up, which is what I'm good at. I'm good at quitting. I'm a quitter. And so I'm out in front of that liquor store looking for a connection to pull up. And I know I'm in the right place because this is the Hostro. So I know there's drug dealers somewhere. And this guy comes out of the liquor store, and he goes, "I know you." And I'm like, "I don't give a shit. Go away." And he goes, "No, I do. I know you. I know you from school. You're the lady who came over and fixed my computer. Hey, I called your house, and your roommate said you don't live there no more." And he just kept going on and on and on and freaking on. He's like, "Dude, go away. I'm a little busy right now." He goes, "I thought you didn't drink." "Oh, I do now. Go away. Can't you see I'm trying to do something here? I'm trying to ruin my life some more." And he goes, "What are you doing out here? You know this is a really bad neighborhood. You really shouldn't be here. You really need to go back to your house. You know there's really dangerous people out here." "I know. I'm looking for those dangerous people. They're the ones who are going to have what I want." And so he just would not stop. And nightfall came, and a woman who was homeless with her four kids in a van had showed up, and I gave her the motel room since my kids weren't there. Better her sleep in the motel room instead of in that van. And I sat out there, and no connection showed, which, of course, was another sign from God for me. And that guy sat there on the hood of his car staring at me all flipping day long. It would not go away. I'm thinking, this guy's a weirdo. And he was a weirdo, but he was a good kind of weirdo. He says, "Where are you going to go now? You gave your hotel room away." And I said, "You know what? You're still here, and you haven't got anything else better to do." He goes, "No." He goes, "I'm a seasonal forklift driver, so I'm off-season. I've got all day." I was like, "Great. Just what I need." He goes, "No, seriously." He goes, "You want to come back to my house?" I go, "Dude, you do not have enough money to take me home. Go away." He goes, "No, seriously, no. No funny business." He goes, "You can sleep on the couch or on the floor or wherever, but not my bed." I go, "Okay, fine." So I went back to his house, which was a little teeny tiny little house. And now I know why he said the floor or the couch, but not his bed, because that's all that was in that room. I had the choice of the floor or the couch, because it wasn't going to be his bed. And I am there, and that night, instead of going to sleep, I spent the whole evening just telling him all the shit that I had been going through. And I don't know why, but I did, and it was easy. I just blurted, just like my daughter always does to me. I just emotionally threw up on him. And that's what I did. I emotionally threw up on him. And I, he said, "Well," he goes, "you know," he goes, "I normally don't do this," which I don't think so. I think he was lying. "But you can stay here." He goes, "You don't have to sleep in my bed, and you can stay here until you get on your feet." He goes, "You're going to try to get your kids back, aren't you?" I go, "Yeah, I think I am going to try to get my kids back." He goes, "Okay." He goes, "Well," he goes, "I'm taking off." And I noticed that he was taking off at noon. Well, before noon, a little before noon, and a little before about 7 o'clock every night. It's like, where's this dude going? So one night, I got curiosity. I said, "Dude, where are you going?" He goes, "Well," he goes, "I didn't want to say anything to you." He goes, "But I'm an alcoholic." I was like, "Oh, fuck. Out of all the people God sent me, he sent me a damn alcoholic." He goes, "Well, I'm going to a meeting." He goes, "I'm not saying you're an alcoholic or nothing, but you can go." So here I am with that same dilemma again. Do I pick the druggy people or do I pick the AA people? What do I do here? Well, the druggy people, I've really had some fucked up years with them. So I thought, okay, I'll give these AA people one more try. So I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous one more time. But this time I came in will the willingness of the dying, because my life had truly hit a bottom not like my others. My other bottoms were bottoms I can handle. I could handle the violence and the drugs and all the other stuff, but the emotional bottom that I hit when I lost my kids was a bottom like I never knew before. And but this time I got a sponsor and I worked the steps and I read the big book, and believe it or not, I started transmitting that thing that they say you can't transmit what you haven't got. And I started transmitting that shit, and people started coming up to me and saying, "Hey, can you be my sponsor?" So I look at my sponsor, and they're not talking to me about being a sponsor, are they? Yeah, we are talking to you about being a sponsor. And I was like, "Well, I haven't got enough time yet." And she goes, "Well, you know, you've been here for a while." And I had been around for a while, and I did learn some things that first time go around in Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't totally oblivious, and I took those first three steps, and on my fourth step, I sat around on it and sat around on it, and procrastinated it, because I didn't want to look at that ugly self of me. And I was living in a little house with an AA roommate, and I had gotten my kids back, and I was 6 months sober again, and life was all right, except for the fact that when I was out there, I had got raped in that 3 days, and I had ended up contracting hepatitis C sometime, and was sick with that, and didn't know whether I got it from the guy who raped me or from my ex-husband or from somewhere I had gotten it. But when they do a rape kit, they, you know, run for STDs. And the doctor was like, "Good news, you don't have AIDS. The bad news is you have hepatitis C." So that was the bad news. And so, you know, I really didn't want to look at my past. I had done a lot of things that I was ashamed of and a lot of stuff that I wasn't proud of at all. And I'm one of those people that when I tell a story about things that go on in my past, I relive it emotionally as I'm telling it. And so I'm doing really good by not crying, because usually by this time I'm just bawling my eyes out. So I'm doing really good today, because I relive it emotionally. And so I really didn't want to look at my fourth step. And one night while I was at a meeting, and my roommate was watching my kids, and my daughter's 6 years old, getting ready to be seven, and my son is 7 years old, he just turned eight, and he molested my six-year-old daughter. And I came home from that meeting, and my daughter's like, "Mommy, I got to talk to you." And it's like, "Why aren't you in bed? I put you to bed before I left for the meeting." She goes, no, "I need to talk to you." And I'm like, "What?" And she's like, "You remember you told me that if anything ever happened to me to tell you, you would make it stop?" I said, "Yes." And she goes, "Well..." And I'm like, "Whoa, wait a minute." And that guy whose house I stayed at when I first got back, he was there with me to come over to have coffee. And I said, "Dude," I said, "I think she's going to tell me something that's going to lead me to prison. I need you to be here witnessing it. So in case I go to prison, there's somebody else here to hear this." And then my daughter proceeded to tell me how my roommate molested her and performed oral sex on her. And I lost it. I went out there sideways, and I was ready to kill him. And that good friend of mine says, "Hey, if you kill that man, who's going to be there for your kids while you're in prison?" And I stopped, and I took a breath, and I thought about it. And the last thing I wanted to do was call the police, but I did. I called the police, and they came and they picked him up, and they took him to jail. And, of course, by the time I made it to a meeting the next day, everybody in AA knew, because you guys know how rumors spread through the AA wildfire. Phew, like that. You want a secret told, just go sit in the AA meeting and tell it. And it'll be across the whole county in one day. So anyway, so I get to the meeting, and everybody has such good, well intentions, and I loved everybody for their well wishing, but I was on emotional overload. I just couldn't take it. Some people were telling me that nothing was going to happen. He was going to get off scot-free. Other people were telling me he was going to get the chair. Other, you know, it was just, I was on emotional overload. And so I went home, and my sponsor was on an Alaskan cruise. and I really wanted her home really bad. And so I pulled that four step out of the drawer, and I sat down, and I unplugged my phone, turned off my cell phone, and locked my door. And for the next few days, I just wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote. And I got done with writing my four step, and my sponsor was still not home. And I felt like that if I didn't unload this, that I was going to get drunk, because I needed a solution right now, and I didn't know any other kind of solution. I was just too out of it. So I went to a meeting, and I sat in a new meeting, and I ran into a newcomer that I knew, and she came and sat down next to me, and I pulled her over, and I said, "Hey, so I'm going to take you home after this meeting. I'm going to tell you my four step, and if you tell anybody, I'll kill you." I was serious. So took her home, and we went through a whole roll of toilet paper together, and I told her my four step, and I felt better, you know, I felt better. And she said something to me that I carry with me to this day. She said, "Leslie," she goes, "you know, the whole killing thing aside, I thought that if I came home with you and I heard your four step, and then I was going to hear all your deep, dark secrets and all the horrible things that you've done, that I would think really less of you after hearing all those things." She goes, "But after hearing all those things and seeing the person that you are today, I can't help but think more of you." And so my sponsor finally came home. Hurrah. And I drove over to her house and told her my four step again, and cried and cried and cried. And she came with me through court and everything, and it was an emotional roller coaster, and I made it through it. And then I proceeded to get sick. I got sick. I got really sick. My hepatitis was, I had fibromyalgia also, and so the two diseases were like making each other worse. And so I was losing more and more of my health, but I was still going to meetings, and I was still doing the deal, and I had 13 sponsees, and I was I knew that book backwards and forwards, and as my good friends called it, I was an AA Nazi is what I had turned into. And I would sit in meetings, and I would throw the book at people a lot, which I try not to do anymore. But my health was just failing, and I had lots of people who were there for me. My sponsees would come over and cook dinners and meals for my kids when I couldn't get out of bed, and people would bring meetings to my house when I couldn't get there. You know, none of my friends I didn't have any friends when I was a drug addict. You know, nobody back in that world would have ever done half the things that people in AA did for me. When I went into the hospital and I was in reverse isolation and everybody else had to get sanitized so that they wouldn't kill me, I still had people around the clock coming to my hospital bed, coming and seeing me, which was just amazing. I got every single AA book there ever was written, because that's what AA people bring, AA people in the hospital. They bring them fucking AA books. I'm just telling you, you go to the hospital, you're getting AA books. Just be prepared. Buy a bookshelf. That's what you're getting. So, yeah, I've got them all. And because I was in the hospital a lot, I had lots of people praying for me and hoping that I'd get better. And I failed the chemo treatment, the Pegasus treatment they had me on, all of the freaking hep jugs that... And I wasn't able to cope. I couldn't take care of my kids. It was getting worse and worse and worse. And I felt bad about putting such a burden on all my sponsees. I felt more like they were nursemaids. I had hospice there taking care of me, and my sponsees were taking care of my kids. And I felt bad. I was like, I can't do this anymore. If I'm going to die, I'm going to die. But I got to stop these drugs, because I can't function with my little children while I'm on them. So I failed it, and I had a count of over 6 million, and I had 80% of my liver destroyed, and my kidneys were failing, and I was really I was okay to die, though. I was at peace with it. I knew that God would provide a way because he had so much so far this time for me. This time when I took two steps forward, I stayed two steps forward, even with through all the adversity I was going through. My life was getting better, even though my health was failing. But, they said, okay, we're just going to put you as a fail for Pegasus treatment and send you home, and hospice will try to make you as comfortable as you can. And you guys know the story. I'm still here, so I evidently beat the shit. So, yeah. I did. Yes, I did. And that was because of my higher power. Went home 30 days later, went to go get tested, and I had everybody and their brother there at my house. I mean, I think I had like all three of the main fellowships in Modesto, California, coming over to my house to say their goodbyes to me. And I kept all the books, too. I didn't give any back because I didn't die. I kept them all. But, you know, 30 days later, I take another test, and they can't find no hepatitis. None. Not even one cell. And they said it must have been a delayed response from the interferon. That's what they said. I mean, the damage to my kidneys was done. The damage to my liver was done. But a few years later, they told me that the stage 3 destruction that they thought was done to my liver, it turns out to be a lot of it was only stage 2, which means that it was restorative, that I could slowly get my liver back. And God just kept giving me these blessings, you know, and I kept working the steps and getting things done and taking my daily inventories and praying to him at night and carrying this message and sharing meetings and co-chairing for the hotline. And I got into all kinds of AA service. And my kids were like, can't somebody else help those AA people, Mom? Can't you stay home with us? Because, you know, they'd never seen me drink or use in their whole life. And so, you know, I did the deal you know, I thought that my life was perfect. You know, I kissed a few frogs, of course, because I still wanted that AA perfect life. I wanted the husband, the kids, the house, the fence, the whole nine yards. And I felt like there was a big piece missing still. And I went to my sponsor, just like, you know what? AA men are weird. You take them home and they're not anything like they are in the meetings. And she's like, well, what kind of AA men are you taking home? And I was like, well, you know, I went out with this one, and I went out with that one, and I went out with this one, and that son of a bitch was going out with me and her at the same time. And she's like, Leslie, she goes, I want you to do something. I go, what do you want me to do now? And she goes, I want you to go home, I want you to write about a man recipe. I go, oh, okay. She goes, I want you to put on that recipe everything that you would want in a man. I said, oh, right. So I went home, I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to write this recipe out, I'm going to pray about it, she's going to do something to it, and I'm going to have this wonderful man step into my life, and I'm going to get that AA dream. So I go home, and I write, all this wonderful, she can't go to, had never been in prison, never. Jail's okay, but prison, no. Can't be on parole, has to have a job, can't live with mom, he can have kids, he must like kids, because I had kids, and he better think my kids are really great, too. So I'm just writing this thing out, and it's like, he's got to be decently looking. I'm not thinking he's got to be great, but God, I got to be able to look at him without going, ugh, you know? And so I got this list, and I take it back to my sponsor. I go, I did it. I wrote the list. Okay, here's my recipe. She goes, shh, shh, shh. I'm like, Janet, what did you do to my list? And she goes, now I want you to go home and pray and get comfortable with never finding that man on that list. And I did not like that. And so I went home, and my sponsor, she was one of those good old hard-ass sponsors that didn't take shit, and she got AA in Alaska. So she was like, she was great. I love Janet. And when I used to call her up with my drama, I'd go, Janet, my house is falling off, da 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 da. And she'd go, did you drink? And I'd go, no. Click. Really? Because don't you know who I am yet? So anyway, so I go home, and I'm trying to understand the AA wisdom of Janet on why she ripped up my paper and why do I need to get the grips that I will never meet that man. And I got it because I had to be comfortable in my own skin and I had to be happy with the now instead of being wanting what wasn't here yet. And learn to be happy with the now because that was my problem. I wasn't ever happy with the now. I was always wanting bigger and better things. Well, I met that AA man, by the way, because, you know, he came in here and spoke 15 minutes before I did. And, you know, when we met, I got to tell you the story of how we met, because Cowboy was chairing the men's meeting and I was chairing the women's meeting. And I had been out on a date with another frog of AA. And I found out that because I would not have sex with him because my sponsor said that I should not be having sex with these men if I wanted to get to know them for who they were and not just for the good sex. So I was not supposed to be having sex with them. So I found out because I wasn't having sex with him that he was having sex with another girl while he was dating me, trying to get me to have sex with him. And I found out that day. So I was really hating men. And I came into my women's meeting, which is the perfect meeting to hate men on. No, just kidding. And Cowboy's sitting there at his meeting, and he's like, "What's the matter, Leslie?" And I'm like, "Damn, men making coffee, you know, and things are flying here, and filters are going there, and coffee's going here." And it's like, I hate them. I'm going to become a lesbian. I'm just done. And my husband-to-be was sitting there in the chair, unbeknownst to me. And he's like to Cowboy after I went off into my women's room, "Who the hell was that?" Well, thank God he didn't remember me from that day. And he was still in a relationship, and I was getting out of relationships. And a few years later, we ran into each other again. And we ran into each other at a meeting, and he was asking about fixing a soda machine. He asked me if I knew who had the keys to the machine. He said, "Of course I know who has the keys to the machine." And so I called the person up, and they said, I gave him the phone and said, "Here, talk to the person that has the keys. I don't have the keys." And I noticed he was driving a Mustang. I was like, "Oh, he's got a Mustang. How cool." So maybe he is worth paying his attention to. So, anyway, so I was very polite and very nice to him. And he was very polite and very nice to me right back. And we went our separate ways. That was it. Didn't ask for my number or nothing. And that night, I ran into him at another meeting. Like, "Are you following me? Are you stalking me? Are you going to be one of those people I have to get a restraining order before I even go out with?" kind of thing. And he's like, "No, I'm not following you. Are you following me?" I was like, "No." And then we ran into each other again the next day at another freaking... And I'm not talking about just different time meetings in the same fellowship. I'm talking different fellowships. I went to three different fellowships in three different days and ran into him. And we ended up going out on a date, and after we went out on the date and had such a lovely time, he found out that I was the crazy psycho woman they had seen coming into that women's meeting, and he was so grateful that he hadn't remembered it because he wouldn't have went out on a date with me. And we got married 2 years later, and he had two children from his previous relationship, and I had two children from mine, and we raised our children together. And like he said, we're celebrating 10 years of marriage, and I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous this time, 15 years of continuous sobriety, and he's celebrating 19, and I got my AA dream finally. So that's my story.